not set one up, so you are really all responsible for your own coffee orders. I'm not quite sure how it's been working up there, but as I say, I apologise that we don't. I did ask on Monday whether or not the machine, which appears to be mobile, could be brought around here, but they didn't take up that invitation, and I haven't turned it into a directional order. Are there any... Ms. Grubbs, good morning.
Sorry, sir. I realise that there's only Wednesday, but looking ahead to Friday, I was interested in an indication as to whether the court may be rising early on Friday afternoon or intending to sit through till 5, just for travel arrangements on this side of the room.
When do you want? Commissioner Mabon is coming from Christchurch, and he indicates that at this stage his calculation is we might need to rise to around 4:30.
Thank you. That's very helpful tonight.
Yeah, no, thank you. And it is a reminder, and probably by the end of today we should take stock and have a clear idea so that anybody who might have been anticipating that they could be on this week, whether or not that's realistic and whether or not witnesses can be told by home until next week. Sorry, week after.
We've had some level of discussion amongst us around that, and I think we are collectively fairly confident that by the end of the third week we will have caught that up.
So. Yes, it seems as, I mean, and this is all often the case, is that a large plan hearing like this can start slowly, but then as people identify what the key issues are and the key points of difference, the examination and cross-examination and submissions focus. So thank you for that.
I think everyone, when we say that we are confident we will finish within the time available.
Well, that's good. And we haven't come back to the issue of a site visit, and that will be something else to look at. But I think at this stage, rather than interrupt the flow for the hearing in terms of the schedule, we'd be looking at doing the site visit in what information they did for the week.
Thank you.
Anything else? I'd also like to thank everyone for their cooperation yesterday afternoon. I think that process went tolerably well, and we got through what we were anticipating to get through. If there are other witnesses in similar circumstances, then I would suggest that we hear their evidence in much the same way. But obviously, I imagine that most people would feel that it's preferable for the evidence to be heard and for witnesses to be cross-examined in the same room. All right. Now, Ms. Tumai.
Good morning, sir.
Good morning.
Cooper will be reading this witness for Mr. Kevin Counsel.
Thank you very much.
I solemnly sincerely and truthfully declare and affirm that the evidence you're about to give for this report shall be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth.
Good morning, Mr. Kansar.
Morning.
Can you confirm that your full name is Kevin Jeffrey Kansar?
Yes.
Did you prepare a statement of evidence dated 28 July 2023?
Yes.
Did you participate in the Economics and Modelling Expert Conference on 5 September 2023?
Yes.
And are you a signatory to the Expert Economics and Modelling Joint Witness Statement?
Yes.
Do you have any corrections to make your evidence?
No, I don't.
Is your evidence true and correct for the rest of your belief?
Yes.
You are now just have a couple of supplementary questions.
Of course. Thank you.
Mr. Counsel, what are the implications for your evidence of the corrections that were made by Dr. Bradshaw to his GIS evidence?
Yeah, so Dr. Bradshaw's analysis was an input to mine, and
he made some slight corrections to the area that were lost to the setbacks. It makes some minor changes to some of the numbers in some of my tables, but the overall results that I found, which was a range of 8 million to 6 million per annum loss, is an opportunity cost. That number doesn't change, and that's because I've rounded those numbers to avoid giving a false sense of precision, and any changes made are within rounding error, so the rounded results don't change.
Thank you, Mr. Councillor. Just have a second question regarding existing fences. I understand that you've been following the hearing and are aware that there were questions, and one of those questions was quantifying the number of water bodies that are already fenced. So my question to you is, what are the implications for your evidence of water bodies that are already fenced?
Yes, so my understanding of Dr. Bradshaw's analysis is that he has calculated the area lost to setbacks from the Director General's proposal across all water bodies in the Waikato region, regardless of whether or not they are fenced. So he hasn't taken account of any existing fencing. And in that sense, his analysis would overstate the amount of land that is lost to setbacks from the DG proposals. And as that flows into my analysis, implications for that, to answer your question, implications of that, my costs would also overstate the costs. And to get a sense of that, I'm aware of some evidence in Dr. Scarsbrook's evidence in check on the amount of fencing that there has been. He's got some 2017 numbers. And he shows something around 90% of dairy land is fenced, either one bank or two banks of the stream, and around, I think the number is around 40% of dry stock land is fenced. So that gives a sense of the amount of fencing and the extent to which my numbers might be an overstatement.
Thank you, Mr. Councillor. Please answer any questions for my friends.
Thank you. Mr. Conway.
No questions. Thank you, sir.
Thank you. Mr. Ryan? No questions, sir. Thank you. Thank you. Mr. Pennell?
No questions, thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Pennell?
No questions, thank you, Your Honour.
Thank you. Ms. Farrick, good afternoon.
No questions.
Thank you. Mr. Matheson of the Federated Farmers. Ms. Edwards?
I have a question.
Thank you.
Good morning, Mr. Council. I am acting for Federated Farmers, who's doing a joint case with Beetham Lamb. The first question I wanted to ask you was just to clarify that the Director General's proposed setbacks for stock exposure are 10 metres from permanent rivers, wetlands and lakes, and 3 metres from ephemeral and intermittent streams, isn't it?
That's my understanding, yes.
Yeah. And the Director General also wants to increase setbacks for cultivation from 5 metres to 10 metres, doesn't she?
Yes, I think that's right.
Yes. And just picking up on that first response you gave to my friend about Dr. Bradshaw's analysis not taking into account areas of land that are already fenced, where Dr. Scarsbrook refers to the amount of fencing that's been done, that's not in respect of ephemeral streams, is it?
It's not entirely clear to me from his evidence whether it is or not. I would presume it's probably not, but I don't know for sure.
And to the extent that it's not ephemeral streams as you're referring to, that that part of Dr. Bradshaw's analysis wouldn't have overstated the area of land to be fenced. To be the area of land for setbacks.
Yes, that's right.
In respect of your opportunity cost assessment, you said that's based on the land areas that were covered by Dr. Bradshaw. Dr. Bradshaw's assessment was a desktop exercise, wasn't it?
I understand it was, yes.
And it was based on models and assumptions around areas and lengths of rivers, lakes, ephemeral streams, wetlands?
Yeah, well, it's not my expertise in my evidence, but that's my understanding of it.
And to the extent that those modelled numbers understate the actual area of setbacks under the Director General's proposal, then your assessment of opportunity costs would similarly be understated.
It would be understated for that reason, yes, but overstated for other reasons as well, as I've just discussed. Yeah.
And by that you mean to the extent that if streams are already fenced, that had been included in Dr. Bradshaw's analysis,
yes,
that component would be overstated. But if Dr. Bradshaw hasn't included areas of streams,
yeah, that's,
yeah,
right. There might be the overs and unders, so to speak.
And there is evidence to suggest that the area of land covered by Dr. Bradshaw's, or covered by the DOCS Director General's proposal, could be larger. That could be the TRG number that Dr. Scarsbrooks refers to being around 11,000 hectares.
Yes, I'm aware of that from Mr. Keenan's evidence. He refers to that. If it is 11,000, would be a lot higher. I have done a separate calculation, actually. Mr. Keenan did a separate calculation, and I've checked that and I confirm it. I'd say that even that is actually a small proportion of the total loss profits, of the total profits made by dairy farming and dry stock. And I mentioned this in the Joint Whip Statement for Economics.
But in terms of your estimate of likely total opportunity cost, if the area of setback was around twice as large, your total numbers of your 8 to 16 million would be,
yeah,
twice as large.
Pure matter of,
yeah,
mathematics, it would be larger.
And you'll have seen it's noted in the Economics Joint Witness Statement that Dr. Lemire's assessment, based on looking at two case study farms, is that the area of streams could be 2 to 9 times larger than the models, the REC model that Dr. Bradshaw relied on.
Yes, I'm aware of it, yes.
Yeah. And to the extent that if it was 2 to 9 times larger, it could have a similar magnitude of impact on your opportunity cost assessment.
Yeah, I'd probably be cautious about drawing economic inferences from a sample of two, but certainly if we take those numbers as given, then it would mean it's larger. Yes, it wouldn't mean it's 2 to 9 times larger, though, because ephemeral streams are a proportion of the total in Dr. Bradshaw's analysis, but it would mean it's larger.
And in terms of the loss of profits that you modelled, you looked at the average profit for a dairy and dry stock farms, didn't you?
Yes, separately, yes.
And you didn't model the profits for arable cropping farms?
No, I didn't, although I have since done a calculation of that, and it makes very limited difference to my figures.
And when you looked at the opportunity cost assessments and the profits, you're looking at average farms, so the actual opportunity cost per farm could be different on an individual farm by farm basis, depending on their particular circumstances.
Yeah, yes, it could be higher or lower, yes.
And my last questions for you are that you've only looked at the opportunity cost, so you haven't looked at the direct cost associated with the setback proposal, the direct cost to farmers associated with the setbacks, have you?
I haven't quantified the direct costs. I have,
yep,
given some thought to fencing costs in my evidence, but I haven't quantified.
You haven't quantified them. So you haven't quantified the costs of reconfiguring and establishing or moving existing fences, gates, crossings and traps as a result of having to provide larger setbacks under the DG proposal?
Well, I'm not an expert in farm systems, so I don't know the extent to whether that, that would be required, whether they would need to move gates. The one comment I'd note on that is it would come down to a farmer's incentives, because it's not a requirement to move paddocks, as you say, it's not a regulatory requirement, so it'll come down to a farmer's incentives. So if it is very costly, it might not be in the farmer's best interest to actually do that.
Have you seen the farmer evidence on behalf of Federated Farmers?
Yes, some of it, yeah.
And so what I'm thinking in there is Mr. Berry and his rebuttal evidence explained some of the, in a map, explained some of the additional areas of, the additional fences he would have to move to deal with practicality issues like needing to be able to muster stock, having having paddocks that were economic enough to be able to farm, to fit in with his grazing practices, needing to move the location of races and things like that. So on an individual farmer basis, these costs, these implications could be significant, couldn't they?
Again, I'm not an expert in farm systems, so I don't know the extent to which that would happen. I have to read Mr. Berry's evidence. He seems to state at the start that he has done a lot of fencing, so I'm not sure why he would need to create the 10-metre setbacks and move his farms. He's already moved his fences. There's already existing fencing in place. So I don't know. I can't comment on to the extent to which that would be required or not.
But for areas where Mr. Berry hasn't fenced, you accept that there may be a need to move these fences, and that would be a direct cost associated with the DG proposal, if that was what a farmer needed to do.
Well, I could say if that was what he needed to do, then yes, it would be a cost. But I can't comment on whether they would need to do it or not. And I couldn't also comment on whether it would be a significant cost, because that requires an assessment of relative magnitude.
And a case-by-case assessment for each farmer.
That's right.
And some of the other costs that could be associated with the increased setbacks under the Director General's proposal could be earthworks for benching and creating a fence line, depending on where that 10 metres landed in a particular paddock from the water body.
Again, I don't have the expertise enough that would be required or not.
But that's not something that you quantified, is it?
It's not, no.
And there could be a need for resource consents, and that would be an additional cost.
Again, I don't really have the expertise to know if there would be a need for resource consents. If there were resource consents required, would be additional costs. And again, just come back to that point four, if the farmers, it's in their incentive to make these changes and incur these costs, and it may not be, so they may not incur these costs.
And some of the other costs could be if you had to move the location of your trough, if the trough was within your 10 metre setback, for example, or if you had to get power supply for pumps or for electric fences, doing weed and pest control within the 10 metre setback, and fencing maintenance. And as you said, those aren't costs that you've quantified, and I expect you would say, would you say that those are costs that would need to be considered on an individual farm-by-farm basis?
Well, those are costs. What I've quantified is the additional or incremental costs of the Director General's proposal relative to PC1. So I would expect a lot of those costs, things like weed control and some of the others you mentioned, would already need to be incurred in the PC1 proposal, so there wouldn't be additional or incremental costs to the Director General's proposal.
But with the weed control, the cost of controlling weeds within a 3-metre setback would be less, you would assume, than within a 10-metre setback.
You might require additional, I don't know how it works entirely, but you might require additional volumes of weed spray, perhaps, which would be additional cost.
And I think Mr. McGibbon's evidence and his rebuttal evidence is that there is also additional labour cost potentially, because with a 3-metre setback he can reach over the fence from the buggy and spray the weeds, whereas a 10-metre setback the buggy can't reach, so he would have to walk the area within the 10-metre setback. So you'd accept there might be an additional labour cost with a larger setback.
There might be an additional labour cost, but at the same time you would save some costs associated with your vehicle. If he's no longer driving the vehicle along the setback, then you would save some costs. So I don't think it necessarily follows. will be a net cost increase.
And except that the vehicle cost could be cheaper than the labour cost.
Well, yeah, it depends how it's going how it's going to play out. So, but I don't think it's sort of axiomatic that it will be a cost increase. It depends on the relative magnitudes of the cost.
So taking all of these direct costs that we've just discussed, on an individual farm-by-farm basis, if you were to add them all up, they could be significant, couldn't they?
Again, I'd be reluctant to use the term significant without wanting to quantify those costs and assess their relative magnitude. There may, and I wouldn't say there definitely will, because as I said, I don't have the farm expertise, there may be some of these costs if the things that you say are required. But whether that's significant or not would require an assessment of relative magnitude to determine that.
Well, I guess put another way, they wouldn't be insignificant, would they?
I'm not sure you can. In the same way, I'm not sure I could make a claim that they're insignificant without assessing, because they may be insignificant. Relative to a farmer's profits, it may not be a big amount of cost that they need to incur here. So I don't know if I could say definitively one way or another.
Okay. No, thank you, Mr. Council. Thank you, Your Honour. No question.
Thank you. Mr. Brothers, for what are you asking?
No, thank you, sir.
Thank you. Ms. Omley, for Fishing Game?
No, thank you.
No, thank you. Horticulture New Zealand, Mr. Mitchell?
Yes.
Thank you.
Doesn't purport to give any estimate of the costs or benefits of the setback proposal for commercial vegetable production, does it?
No, it doesn't. As I mentioned before, I have since done a calculation of that using some figures from Dr. Olivodi's evidence on profits. For horticulture it was, and it changes the bottom end of my results from 8.2 to 8.4 million, so it's within rounding error.
Yes, but in your actual evidence that we've all had a chance to read and think about, you haven't done anything
right.
At CVP.
Yeah.
And hearing what you're saying about this additional modelling, be that as it may, can you appreciate why CVP would need separate consideration if you were going to offer robust conclusions about the costs? It would need to be separately considered to other farmers.
Yes.
And that's because there's major differences with how CVP operates, right?
I don't know how CVP operates relative to other farms, so I couldn't say either way, I'm sorry.
But do you know that crop rotation, for example, is a fundamental aspect of CVP?
At a high level, yes. Yeah.
Yeah. And have you seen the evidence about the high proportion of leasing of land that has to occur for CVP growers to do their thing?
I don't think I have seen that, sorry.
Okay. So is it fair to say you're not really in a solid position to offer your expert opinion on a realistic estimate of the cost of the setback proposal for CVP specifically?
I think certainly in terms of estimating the opportunity cost of the land, of the lost land, the principle is much the same as what I've set out in my evidence. There's a setback applied, and so there's some lost land that would otherwise be productive, and so you look at the lost profits on that land, and that's the figure I was talking about just before. So I believe I would have some expertise to be able to offer on that particular aspect of it.
But mightn't your assumption that they're broadly similar be misguided when you do take into account the characteristics of crop rotation, leasing, swapping land between growers, long planning periods, crop rotation, and so on?
I'm not sure how that would affect, how all those factors you discussed would affect the fact that you'd still lose some land that would otherwise be in a productive capacity because of the increased setback, and therefore there's some lost profits associated with that land. I'm not sure how it would be affected by things like crop rotation.
Well, couldn't it be more significantly affected than the amounts you've suggested for the other types of farming? Because of those factors?
I'm not sure how it would. I don't know how they would play into that. I would just assume that it's a lost profit amount from the land that you would have otherwise been used in production.
And do you know anything about the commercial drivers and constraints that commercial vegetable production faces?
Other than a broad understanding of economic incentives for businesses, and which includes farmers generally, I don't have much knowledge of commercial vegetable production specifically.
Mm. And that's fair enough, but in light of that, I put it to you that your evidence about the costs and benefits of setbacks for CVP are simply not applicable. Do you agree with that?
No, I wouldn't agree with that. Actually, I think that, as I said, the general concept of the fact that you're losing some land to an increased setback, I think it should still apply.
Sure.
To CVP.
I saw that when it came to the joint witness statement for economics, that was the first time that I detected you did weigh in with evidence about CVP specifically. Is that right?
Yes, I think there were some questions associated with it.
Yes.
That I had some comments on.
Yes, and there were some where I think you responsibly put up your hand and said, well, I actually... this isn't within my scope of expertise, is that right?
Yeah, there was a range of questions at the end related to crop rotation and things like that, which I said beyond
my
expertise.
And one of those was a question about how various proposals would affect the viability of CVP, wasn't it?
Yes.
Question 13, wasn't
yes.
it?
Yes, yep.
Yeah, so that was one where you considered you didn't have... sufficient expertise to weigh in, is that right?
Yes, correct.
Yeah. And so even though you quite properly accepted that's not really something you know about, do you still feel happy enough to say, well, that fundamental principle of opportunity cost is the same, so I think I can give evidence about the effects on CVP.
Yes, I do feel comfortable saying that, yes. Mm-hmm.
And I think another item you disagreed with some of the other economists, is this right? You thought the setback proposal wouldn't have an impact on vegetable prices?
Yes.
don't think that...
Sorry. Not quite right. I did agree it would have an impact on vegetable prices.
Yes.
It was the associated health impacts where the disagreement was. Sorry.
Okay. Got it. Yeah. Thank you. So the chain of reasoning that you have these greater setbacks, so there's going to be less land available, and so supply is more constrained, and so the prices of vegetables produced in this area will increase.
Yes.
And it's just that last step where you say, well, I don't see the link between more costly veggies and people's health suffering.
Yeah,
right.
More costly veggies produced out of the Waikato region. And the reason for that is when price goes up, and this is a simple economic relationship, when price goes up, people will substitute to alternatives. And so simply if the price of all fruit and vegetables goes up, and people might go, okay, I'm going to substitute from that to pack of chocolate biscuits, then that's an adverse health impact.
Yes.
But if the price of only some vegetables goes up, then I would suggest that the most direct substitute will be other fruit and vegetables that people will most likely substitute. So they're not going to be the adverse health impacts associated with that.
Yeah, and I can see that might be right if it's me, you know, with a market stall on a Sunday, people might not. I'm not really a mover and a shaker. But do you think that it's a bit different when we're talking about a region with, well, a catchment with over 200 growers growing over 60 different types of fruit and vegetable crops, where 90% of the vegetables grown here are for domestic supply? Don't you think that changes your, undermines the rationale of what you're saying somewhat?
I don't think it does, because there's still a number of the other fruit and vegetables. I mean, some of the evidence I've seen, and I believe this was in Dr. Ola Bodie's evidence, is that there is 50% of a certain type, a couple of categories of fruit and vegetables, 40% of it, of, I think it was sort of lettuce and summer vegetables, something like that, and 5% of all other types. So there's a really small proportion grown across a broad range of vegetables. So I don't see it impacting the price across all fruit and vegetables together in all of New Zealand, which is what I think would have to be shown for it to be an adverse health impact. And that, I think, is, this was in Mr. Ford's evidence. He referred to a Deloitte paper, and that's what that paper, or Deloitte analysis, that would, what that was showing a price increase in all fruit and vegetables and the adverse health impacts of that. I can't see that happening here. I think it's quite a long bow to draw to suggest that an increase in setbacks is going to have all these adverse health impacts.
Right. So to sort of oversimplify, sorry, but you're saying that the quantity of vegetables grown in this area is just not big enough for it to affect vegetable prices?
Well, yes, but not the quantity in terms of total volumes.
Mm.
The quantity in terms of the range, perhaps, is probably a better way to put it, the range of the vegetables grown.
Mm. Do you know much about SVGAs?
No.
All right. You know that Pukekohe is a specified vegetable growing area?
I'm broadly aware of that.
Yeah. And you know there's only two of those in the country?
I didn't know that.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I put it to you, if you did know in a bit more detail about what actually is growing here and how significant it is, might that change your opinion on this aspect?
Again, the evidence I've seen is that the range grown there does not cover all possible types of vegetables. So that's the evidence I've seen on it.
But it doesn't have to, you don't have to grow every possible type of vegetable, do you, for the price to be affected if the supply is constrained?
No, that's true, yep.
Mm.
Yep.
And there are at least some crops in this area like potatoes, aren't there, where the mild climate here and the fertile soils mean that suppliers from this area can actually do things like offer spring potatoes where it's too cold to offer that from other areas. Did you know that?
I didn't know that.
Well, now that you do, can you see that that's perhaps a small example, but that's an example, isn't it, of the significance of growing things in this area, which you can see how that could affect price if supply was constrained.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. I'm not disputing that there won't be a price impact. I think, I mean, it's a matter of basic economics. You constrain supply, you get price increases. But I just don't believe it necessarily follows that it will have adverse health impacts when people have other products to be able to substitute to that may not necessarily be impacted by price in the same way.
Okay. And so is that, in terms of that chain of reasoning, is that the sort of the single chink in the chain as you see it? The link between those two things?
Yes.
So so you don't take issue, do you, with the proposition that if it did drive the price of vegetables up, at that national scale, then there would be detrimental health effects. You don't take issue with that proposition?
Yeah.
With the other, of course.
Sort of assuming the answer, but yes, if it does drive the price of all vegetables up, and people substitute away from vegetables, if that's the assumption you make, then yes, I imagine there would be some adverse health effects.
Yeah, and it's not just about your imagination, is it? There's studies like the Otago clean corn study, isn't there? You're aware of that one?
No, I'm not aware of that one, no.
Okay. Have you read Mr. Ford's evidence in chief?
Yes.
Okay. But you wouldn't be disbelieving it if that study found that even a small percentage increase in veggie prices will lead to material reduction in people consuming vegetables.
It makes sense as a proposition.
Yeah. And I suppose you can't comment then on the estimate of a nearly $500 million estimate of increased health costs across those various scenarios of veggie prices going up.
Is that from the study you just mentioned?
Yes.
Yeah.
I can't really comment on it.
Yeah.
Are you aware that science on the science on water quality improvements from implementing these blanket setbacks for CVP isn't clear cut?
That's beyond my expertise, really.
Oh, yeah.
The science of it.
Yeah. But if it is debatable whether setbacks will work for CVP, is that uncertainty something that a serious assessment of costs and benefits would need to factor in somehow?
Can I just check I'm understanding
the
question? Are you saying, would I need to factor in scientific uncertainty as to how setbacks would impact?
Yeah, so if they might not be effective for CVP in all situations, and then you go as an economist to the benefit side of the ledger, do you simply assert, well, the benefit is X, or do you have to moderate the magnitude of that benefit because of that uncertainty?
Certainly, as economists, when we look at costs and benefits, it is important to sensitivity test them and to account for uncertainty in some way. It is not just this is the figure.
Yeah.
So you would certainly, if there is some uncertainty in that would suggest some range of benefits, perhaps you would certainly incorporate some sort of analysis to capture that. Yeah.
Yeah, but you haven't done that for setbacks applied to CVP.
Well, I haven't done any monetisation of the benefits, no.
And you haven't given qualitative explanatory evidence about that aspect to CVP either?
No, the benefit side of it has been more covered by some of the other experts for the Director General.
And would it be reasonable to give some consideration as an economist to alternatives to a blanket 10 metre setback for CVP? Well, would that be a reasonable exercise to undertake if you were trying to get to the bottom of the net benefit of the 10 metre setback proposal?
I guess that, you know, I mean, firstly, I wasn't asked to look at that specifically, but certainly if you had plenty of time and I guess plenty of money, there are a number of things you could look at, and that would be one of them.
And so I hear what you're saying, that you weren't asked to look at it. But are you at least aware of things like sediment retention ponds or the requirements of the FEPs that are proposed as part of PC1?
I'm broadly aware of some of those requirements, yes.
Yeah. So even if you didn't have, a huge amount of budget to do a full, you know, quantitative with a whole bunch of counterfactuals and so on, it would still be appropriate to explain that there are these alternatives and that they may be effective, wouldn't it?
Yeah, certainly one of the key aspects of conducting cost-benefit analysis is to define the counterfactual, and there may be more than one counterfactual, so it's certainly appropriate to look at alternatives if you were conducting that sort of exercise.
And if it turned out that those alternatives were likely to be more effective than the 10 metre blanket setback, then that would be that would be a relevant consideration, wouldn't it, when you come to think about whether the 10 metre setback is the right, you know, is the right response.
So economic analysis wouldn't be able to answer the question of whether they are more effective or not. It would be able to answer a question of whether the benefits exceed the costs.
Mm.
And so if you looked at a different counterfactual, the benefits exceeded the costs by more under that alternative counterfactual, then yes, that would be a relevant consideration. You might say the net benefits are greater in some other counterfactual than the 10 metre index, for example.
Right, so it's for others, the expert areas, to come to the court and explain how these alternatives work and whether they're effective or more effective.
Yes, yeah, that's beyond my expertise as an economist.
Yes, thank you. Well, those are the questions I had, Your Honour.
Thank you. Waikato and Waikato River Iwi, Mr. Ferguson.
No questions, sir.
Thank you very much.
You a number of questions regarding the on-farm costs in the context of dry stock and vegetable. Your economic analysis comes down to the benefits and costs. So in terms of those direct costs, the analysis also needs to look at the direct benefits, and there could be direct benefits on farm, such as reduced farm costs.
Yeah, so there's a number of factors that I set out in my evidence that would, I've not referred to them as benefits so much as more offsetting costs. The benefits are more the kind of water quality benefits, as I said, that other experts have considered. But these various factors. factors that offset against the cost. So, for example, if you're going to have fencing at 10 metres from waterways rather than 3 metres, there's going to be a reduced risk of flood damage. If you're fencing ephemeral streams versus not fencing them, you're going to reduce the risk of stock losses from drowning. And there are also benefits from from improved water quality, that the stock are drinking better quality water, so you reduce health cost vet bills and things like that. So these are all offsets. So while there may be some various things that increase the costs on farms, there are also various things that offset against this, which I haven't accounted for in my evidence.
Thank you.
I just have one thing I'd like to raise with you, Mr. Council, and as your council, very complicated, just explored. You've primarily been looking at, if you like, on-farm costs, and then in terms of the benefits, you've said you've been looking at the wider benefits of water quality in terms of Plan Change 1. To what extent is it reasonable in looking at all of this in terms of a benefit cost assessment to consider wider demand issues that may exist in the market for the products of these farms and what those markets may say they expect in terms of what is produced? So, for example, manufacturers of products made from agricultural or pastoral produce may say, well, we need to be able to tell our consumers certain standards have been met in the production of our products, and so we will go back to suppliers and say, to what extent can you confirm that this, you know, that the ethical production, and you can include ethical treatment of animals, the ethics may go to environmental ethics and whether or not the producers have been meeting certain standards. To what extent is that relevant to your analysis for the purposes of this plan change?
Yeah, so you can certainly capture those sort of, I guess you call them downstream markets.
Yeah.
You could certainly capture benefits in downstream markets from that. So, for example, if downstream suppliers were able to command a price premium from offering a higher quality in the sense of, as you say, you know, environmental benefits, they'd offer a higher quality product. That is what the economists would call a surplus gain, or a net benefit, essentially. So that sort of thing would be included in a cost-benefit assessment.
For the purposes of this case, and in relation to primary production in the Waikato and Waipa catchments, is there enough information available to enable you to make any assessment of that?
I don't think there is. It's probably pretty difficult to come to a solid view on how that's all going to play out. It requires quite a number of assumptions, so be uncertain.
Generally, in terms of your work as an economic consultant, do you follow market trends in order to see if that information is available and should be brought into account?
I'm not a macro economist, so the macro economists more follow the general market trends. I mean, certainly for the purpose of this project, I could go away and assess what sort of information is available to be brought into account, but I don't really follow those market trends on a regular basis like that, like other macro economists do.
But this is what you would regard as a macroeconomic matter. The focus here of you and your peers in giving evidence in this case has been a more microeconomics assessment.
I may have misunderstood your last question. So following trends more broadly is probably more a macroeconomic matter, but to the extent that it needs to be captured in a cost-benefit analysis, that is something that is a microeconomist. Does that answer your question?
Yes, no, I see. Again, it's like most things, there's no sharp dividing line between these things, but it's really a question of the context of the analysis that you're
doing.
Yes,
yes, exactly.
If first customers, that is to say the people who buy from the primary producers, were demanding certain standards. And those standards related to or were similar to or possibly went further than the regulatory requirements being imposed by councils or by governments, that would be affected, that you, if there were evidence of it, that would be affected to take into account at that stage.
Yes, I think that would be a relevant factor.
If Nestle said we will not take milk unless it has been produced in a certain way, and you have verifiable information about that, then you take that into account.
I think it would be a relevant consideration.
Relevant consideration.
Yes.
Do you solemnly, sincerely, and truthfully declare and affirm that the evidence you're about to give to the court shall be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth?
Good morning, Ms. Pissett. Good morning. Is your full name Deborah Helen Pissett?
That's right.
And you hold the qualifications set out in your evidence?
I do.
And you prepared evidence dated the 28th of July? You also attended expert conferencing and planning, two sessions of expert conferencing.
That's right.
Do you have any corrections to make to your evidence?
Yes, I do. I'd like to delete paragraph 174 from my evidence. It's just an incorrect paragraph that shouldn't stay in there.
The decision version of Schedule C only applies?
Yes, that's the one.
Yeah, and just the whole thing comes out.
The whole thing comes out. Thank you. And one other correction is to paragraph 245. Here, my planning fingers have got away on me. It should say residual adverse effects rather than residential. Thank you. That's all the changes.
Thank you. So with those changes, do you confirm your evidence to be true and correct to the best of your belief and knowledge?
I do.
Thank you. Please answer your question.
Thank you.
Oh, sorry. I wonder, Ms. Omley, should you go?
Yes, I should, and I have no questions.
Oh, that's not.
Thank
you.
Thank you, Your Honour. And good morning, Ms. Kizak. Now, I've been guided by your counsel's helpful legal submissions in terms of the relief that remains an issue, and so essentially what I'd like to do is step through some of the points in your evidence where you address the matters that are still sought, or the changes that are still sought by the Director General. So the main document that would be good for you to have in front of you is your evidence, which I'm anticipating you have there.
Yes,
great. So the first point I want you to take you to is policy one, which in the version you set out at paragraph 83 of your
83.
Yes.
Yes.
And so my understanding, based on the Department's Director General's legal submissions, is the only change the Director General is still seeking to policy one is the first one of those in paragraph A. Is that your understanding too?
Yes, that's my understanding, yes.
And so the addition that you have sought there in A is to include the words to achieve the interim target attribute states in Table 311.1 within 10 years of this plan being operative. Now, those words are reproduced here from Objective 2, aren't they?
Yes.
So essentially what you're seeking to do is emphasise or reinforce that key element of objective two in the policy itself. Would you accept that as a matter of planning practice, repeating part of an objective in a policy is start with not essential as a general proposition?
Not always essential, no.
So here it's something that you're recommending, but if it wasn't in there, the plan would still be clear in terms of objective two, that that's what the plan is, or the plan change is trying to achieve, isn't it? There's no doubt that objective two would still emphasise the desirability of achieving those interim targets for these things.
I think that's correct. I think where the changes I'm suggesting add value are that they provide clarity around the general improvement that is otherwise mentioned in the policy, and I'm trying to link that policy to what the general improvement might look like, and I think it's important that the target attribute states in Table 3 are the one I mentioned.
Thank you. Now, skipping forward a few pages to paragraph 96, where you discussed some of the policy 2 amendments. Have you got that in front of you? And the change there in paragraph D2 and the second bullet point, as I understand it, the key change that's being sought still is the addition of the wording and or leaching in relation to that bullet point. Have I understood that correctly?
Yes, that's right.
And so this clause in its current form, as in the council's version, sets out matters that a resource consent and the FEP should have regard to, doesn't it?
Just give me a minute.
Maybe assistance if you may want to have the council's version in front of you just for comparison purposes and to see it in context and conscious that what you're looking at here are a snippet. So feel free to pull that one up too if that's useful. Paragraph D is headed up for the purposes of B and C, any relevant resource consent and farm environment plan should have regard to the following matters. So that's what it's
the
context
you.
Is, isn't it?
Yeah. Sorry, can you answer the question?
So these are, we've covered it really, this clause is about matters that a resource consent and FEP should have regard to.
Yeah, that's right.
Mr. Tribilco's rebuttal evidence and reference for the court is paragraph 97 states, the point of this clause is for the farmer to think about how water runs off the farm to sensitive water bodies. And he says, I do not consider it is about assessing the likelihood that nitrate will leach to the water bodies, and that's why he doesn't support that change. Do you accept that the focus of this clause is on overland runoff rather than leaching, or is that a point you disagree with him?
I agree that as Mr. Trebelko has proposed it, it would only relate to runoff, surface runoff. I guess my concern with that limitation is that it doesn't address all of the contaminant pathways to water bodies, and that's why I've suggested that leaching be included.
Right. And so your preference would be that the farmer needs to look into the information that exists around leaching as well as runoff when deciding what measures they might need to put into the farm environment plan.
Yeah, I think in particular this is in relation to sensitive receiving environments, so lakes and wetlands, and I think that a fulsome consideration of how contaminants track to those sensitive receiving environments is useful.
And in terms of the practical mitigation measures that a farmer might look to implement, if they did have that additional focus of leaching as well as overland runoff,
yep,
are you in a position to comment on what additional matters they might need to bring to bear on their farm management decisions, or is that not something
that's
you can
not your expertise of mine?
Stepping over to paragraph 158 of your evidence, you've got some comments there on further parts of policy 2.
Yes.
And we're at paragraph F initially of policy terms of the way they're currently framed in Mr. Trebilco's version, F and G are about when, respectively, when stock are to be excluded from water bodies, and G about where what to do when stock exclusion is not achieved, and then H relates to riparian buffers, doesn't it? That's the way it's currently framed.
Yes.
And so, actually, if you can skip in the post-conferencing version to Schedule C, if you can have that open alongside this. Schedule C, Clause 3, states that found stock on the river must not enter or pass across the bed of a caused by a water body, except when using a livestock crossing structure or when they're being supervised and actively driven across the water body in one continuous movement. Now, that clause essentially recognises that there may be situations where it's necessary or perhaps appropriate to have stock driven across the water body rather than being completely excluded from it. Would you accept that's what that's providing for?
Yes.
And in that situation, it may not be possible to prevent, in a complete sense, the deposition of faeces, but it's still important to minimise it. And that's presumably why Clause 3 requires stock to be actively driven across in one continuous movement, so that
yes.
any deposition is minimised. Would you accept that Policy 2B, F's reference to or minimise, provides policy support for that requirement? Now, coming down to the remainder of the changes you've sought here, and you've sought some changes at the end of G and at the start of H.
Yeah.
So, again, coming back to how these work together and relate to each other, at present, paragraph F seeks to exclude stock. Paragraph G sets out how the aims of stock exclusion should still be sought if stock are not excluded. And paragraph H deals with riparian buffers. Now, in terms of your recommended changes to paragraph G, so it's down the bottom of blue text there, and you talked about achieving the environmental outcomes of stock exclusion, and your new words, and setbacks for riparian buffers in 2BH. Now, if that change was not made, would you accept that riparian buffers would still be encouraged in all circumstances in paragraph 8?
Yeah, I guess the change that I'm suggesting there is to recognise that there are environmental benefits beyond stock exclusion, so that the setbacks create environmental outcomes in addition to those from simply excluding stock from waterways. So what I am attempting to do here is to recognise those additional environmental benefits, which are largely covered by the descriptions of riparian buffers in H. So I've just attempted to attach those two things together, essentially. So that stock exclusion has some benefits, and setbacks and riparian planting have additional benefits.
Yes, and at the moment focusing specifically on riparian buffers, perhaps it's a minor point, but your addition to G in terms of riparian buffers would duplicate what's story in H, in the net effect of how this policy is applied. There's no circumstances where someone wouldn't be required to apply H where your riparian buffers are to be carried. Then turning to the setback component, in particular, your recommended changes to H. If those changes are not made, paragraphs F and G will still provide policy support for stock exclusion and its goals, won't they? If you look through F and G in their present form, all of the things in F and G, while they specifically refer to stock exclusion, they're all benefits of setbacks too, aren't they?
Yes, I accept that.
Now, I'd like to turn to paragraph 193 briefly. And I'm not sure if you have a copy in conjunction with the handy cheat sheet that Federated Farmers and Beef and Land have had earlier on. Is there another copy of that? I think we've got a clean one here. Paragraph B refers to a 20-metre setback from the edge of the rural lanes. Now, I understand there is a distinction between what some of the experts you've relied on recommend, and they've continued to support 20 metres, but the Director General's case is 10 metres.
That's right.
And so my understanding, when I'm looking at this one-pager, is that in terms of the Director General's position, we should read the top right two boxes as 10 instead of 20 metres. Is that your understanding?
So named lakes and unnamed lakes?
Yes, that's right, you're on. So I've changed that on my version to 10 metres just for my own reference. And the other row I've added in my version is the one just up the top where I've suggested there could be another row of cultivation, and I've said the council proposal is 5 metres. With those, that addition and the amendment, does the right-hand column accurately represent the Director-General's position as you understand it?
Can I just take a moment?
Yes. So good.
Thank you.
So I'm grateful to my friend for producing that one paper. It's proven very helpful. Now, Ms. Kissick, I'd like to turn things for reference only to the deleted paragraph 174 that don't think the deletion stands in the way of the matters I want to touch on here with you, but it was the reference point in your evidence that that I found useful for this. In terms of the slope at which various stock exclusion requirements would apply, I understand from your paragraph 176 that your preference is for the decisions version with the 15 degrees, is that right?
That's right.
And you're aware that Mr. Trebilco recommended moving to a 10 degree slope for reasons of practicality, because that's what the mapping was that was available through the MFE low slope maps?
I understand that was his reason, yes.
Yes. And were you in court when Commissioner Maven asked Mr. Trebilco some questions that related to more recent mapping, even as recently as last week, that may provide more accurate definition of slopes, perhaps up to 15?
I wasn't here for that.
You weren't here?
No.
Okay. Well, at a general level, if more accurate maps were available, and if the wording in Schedule C was to be amended so that instead of specifically referring to the MFE low slope maps, it kept it more open to applying or using whatever the most recent and accurate maps were, would you support that kind of change?
Would you specifically be referencing a map or just leaving the text open as you suggest through some sort of map?
Well, I'm interested in your view on that, because I guess I'm signalling through the question that something that the council is looking at, and to enable the Mr. Trebilco and the court to have the benefit of your view, would it be better, and you're welcome to turn to Schedule C so you can see the way it's worded at present.
Yeah, perfect, yeah.
But Schedule C, stock exclusion 1 and A and B both refer to, so we have the words as identified in the Ministry for the Environment stock exclusion low slope map. Mm-hmm. Now, in the event there was a desire to shift to the flexibility I've just described, from your perspective, would it be better to simply strike out those rude words, or would it be better to refer to something else in there in its place? And I appreciate I'm putting you on the spot with that, but
yeah.
I'd be interested in your view on that.
Yeah, I absolutely agree that having a map is very useful, and we addressed that in the planning joint witness statement as well. My understanding is that the only reason for the change from 15 degrees to 10 degrees was the presence of a map, and since that time I understand Mr. Dupree has presented a map in his evidence using a similar data set from MFE used to develop the low slope map, which can be used to 15 degrees. So I would absolutely support a map to provide farmers with some comfort around what the slopes are. In the planning and joint witness statement, and I can take you to the paragraph if you like, we did discuss the recent amendments to the stock exclusion regulations, and in particular the ability for low slope land to be defined as the map, or basically ground truth to correct the map if there were any errors, and I would support something along those lines. So I'd like to take you through the joint statement on that.
Yes, and it's really just to clarify if there's any wording that to remind me whether that included some wording.
Yeah.
Whether you've got some you could add.
Under the comments on clause 1, the third paragraph down refers to a number of experts, including myself, agreeing that an approach identifying land subject to stock exclusion should involve a map that can subsequently be ground truth to address any material mapping anomalies and accurately determine the slope.
And so if the starting point point you're making there, you and the other experts, is that if that map proved to be inaccurate when a farmer looked on site, it would be better to enable the farmer to use the on-site measurement rather than the mapped one. Is that part of the point you're kind of making in that paragraph?
That's right. So I accept that not all mapping is 100% accurate, and certainly I'm aware of examples on Mr. Berry's farm, for example, where it is mapped as low slope but is in fact not. So to avoid those situations and make sure that things are as accurate as they can be, I think allowing for some correction on the ground is appropriate.
Thank you. And I see the following paragraph in that statement refers to some additional text, which several witnesses talked about, and it's green and highlighted on the next page.
That's right, yeah,
quite a bright green. And so you've said there, for the purpose of clause A and B, with land with a slope of X degrees is land shown on any X map, unless the slope of the land is found to be different when measured over any 20 metre distance of the land.
That's right, yeah, that would be helpful. I would support those changes.
Right, thank you.
I guess, can I just add to my response on that? In terms of the low slope map, I guess I did have concerns that since it had been released by the Ministry for the Environment, it had been subject to a number of changes. So I do consider there is benefit in a map being held by the council that you are in control of, the council is in control of, in terms of any changes, because if it's directly being used in the plan rules, I think that's a useful certainty for land users.
Yes, understood. I'm sure it won't be me personally who's monitoring that map. If I can take you to paragraph 239 of your evidence, you talk about policy 5. Just know when you're there.
Sorry, paragraph number again.
239.
Yes.
And this one is the one that relates to offsetting compensation. Were you able to observe or listen to the Dr. Corkery gave evidence yesterday?
Yes, I was here.
And so in a similar vein to the matters that I traversed with her, your concern, I think, and reliance at least partially on her evidence, is that this policy approaches offsetting compensation in a way different from what the NPSFN does. Is that broadly fair?
I understand that from Mr. Taraco's evidence.
Yes, and from his evidence, as I relayed to Dr. Corkery, there is a reason for that. And so whether or not you agree with that reason at this point, there is you'd acknowledge that this has been designed for a particular purpose.
I do struggle with the use of the language and the policy if it's not intended to apply to offsetting and compensation as identified in the NPSFM, for example, now, and in relation to the principles of offsetting and compensation, which I believe it is not intended to do.
Well, we'll come to that in a moment, but for the start, but just to reiterate the point that Mr. Dribilko said, he said the purpose of Policy 5 is to provide for land use change and CDP expansion by allowing any increase in nitrogen, phosphorus, sediment or microbial pathogens to be offset or compensated in a way that still achieves the objectives of 235 month. And as I traversed with Dr. Corkery, and I think she accepted that Policy 5A does deal with offsetting and compensation. Do you recall that answer that she gave?
I'll just go to the council's version. I am concerned with the language used in A, that it talks about an overall reduction, which to me signals that it may not be, that there may be some unders and overs, option. So I think in terms of overall, I do find that that is somewhat inconsistent with the direction that I understand from the Indians wanting to go in terms of Te Tui Whanau.
I'm intending to take you through that wording momentarily. Just as a starting point, though, I just wanted to check, do you agree or disagree with Dr. Corkery that this policy 5A does provide for offsetting and compensation?
Not on its own, I don't agree that it provides for offsetting and compensation.
I'd be grateful if you could explain your answer.
So there are a number of components to Policy 5, obviously. So A on its own does not provide for offsetting and compensation.
Is that connected with your concern about the use of the words "an overall reduction"?
Yeah, it is.
You'll see there the wording is "an overall reduction in the relevant subcatchments of the diffuse discharge of each of nitrogen, phosphorus, sediment and microbial pathogens."
Mm-hmm.
Do you accept that on their face those words don't provide for the overs and unders approach that you're concerned related to?
I think it would depend on the specific subcatchment. So I note that the decision from the council level hearings discussed the fact that minor increases in contaminants shouldn't be provided for in subcatchments where they're already over allocated. So I think it would depend on the specific subcatchment when you're considering each of those contaminants.
Because if I can tell you how I read it, and you can tell me whether you agree or disagree, if we're sticking purely within A at the moment, the offsetting of compensation would need to show that on an overall basis there is a reduction in the diffuse discharge of nitrogen and phosphorus and sediment and microbial pathogens. So an overall reduction in all four is what it's pushing for. Do you accept that's what it says on its face, or is that something we just disagree on?
I accept that it says that, except for the "or" at the end of this, of the clause. So you can do that, or you can do something else.
I understand that point, and we will come on to talking about those other parts. But if someone stopped at A, they are required under that. If they were to show "I've satisfied 5A, they would need to show an overall reduction in all four contaminants, wouldn't they? Otherwise, they would have bumped into something below that.
Yeah, and again, I come back to the overall reduction comment.
Well, I'm interested in that because your wording would change it to "at least no net increase." Now, when I look at the comparison between the words "an overall reduction" but versus "at least no net increase,"
mm-hmm.
if your starting point is a baseline of 10 in each of the contaminants, my understanding is that your wording would require it to stay at 10 and no more, whereas the wording that's there at present is stricter than that and would actually require a reduction. So are you seeking to make this clause stricter or more lenient?
I don't agree that an overall reduction is stricter than what I've proposed.
Okay, I don't think we need to take that any further at this point. In terms of this policy as a whole, and the way it's, what it's intended to do, you're aware that to the beyond what's in A in the council's version. One of the types of land use change that Plan Change 1 is endeavouring to provide for is development of Tangata Whenua ancestral land that, due to the timing of treaty settlement processes, may not have been able to be developed before now. You're aware of that?
Yes.
And that's a particular circumstance that is relevant here that, I suppose, from a planning perspective, creates a challenge to resolve in terms of how that could be dealt with while still achieving Te Tiriti Whaimana in terms of the restoration of the river. You can see that's a challenging scenario.
Absolutely.
And so in that particular situation, if the court were to determine that some level of intensification may be necessary or may need to be provided for as at least an avenue in this plan change for development of Tangata Whenua ancestral land as one of the examples. And if that couldn't achieve orthodox offsetting compensation principles, one of the ways to provide pathway would be to have a carefully constructed approach that allowed perhaps some unders and overs in relation to the four contaminants. Whether or not you agree with it or disagree at this point, would you accept that's one of the pathways that could be adopted?
Yes.
And so the question of whether that is adopted here or not depends on the court's level of comfort with providing an avenue that differs slightly from the orthodox approach to offsetting and compensation.
When you say the orthodox approach, do you mean the approach in the MPSFM?
For now, yes, let's treat that as the orthodox approach.
Yes, I agree with that.
And so ultimately it comes down to that question of levels of comfort with providing slightly more flexibility than might otherwise be the case.
Yes.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Kissa.
Thank you. Thank you. How long it might you be?